From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Religion plus politics equals fireworks. Barack Obama is taking heat because his pastor criticized America. Here's an excerpt of a 2003 sermon by Reverend Jeremiah Wright.
The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. That's in the Bible for killing innocent people. God damn America for treating our citizens as less than human.
Now Obama says his pastor's words go against his beliefs. Is that enough to keep his association with Wright from hurting his campaign? In a few minutes, we're going to talk to a theologian and a reporter with very different views of the Wright-Obama connection. But first, we're joined by NPR senior correspondent Juan Williams. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Farah.
So, Juan, this weekend, Reverend Wright's church, the Trinity United Church of Christ, released a statement which read in part, quote, "This is an attack on the legacy of the African-American church, which led and continues to lead the fight for human rights in America and around the world." That part was from Reverend Otis Moss III. He's going to be taking over as pastor of Trinity when Reverend Wright retires. The statement also includes words from the president of the denomination, Reverend John H. Thomas. Thomas said, "It's time for us to say no to these attacks." Juan, are these statements by church leaders, and we should add the president of the denomination is white, enough to end this controversy?
No, I'm afraid not. You know, the whole idea is not so much that Senator Obama is being held responsible for what Reverend Wright had to say as that he maintained an association with the church for more than 20 years. As has been said, there's a litany of connections. He was married in the church. His children were baptized in the church. And he's someone who took the title of his most famous of his book, The Audacity of Hope, from a Wright sermon. So he now says that in some cases he just wasn't there, was unaware of what Reverend Wright had to say. And that started a sort of odd game for Wright, in which now reporters are saying, well, was he there on this Sunday when this controversial sermon was delivered? But what we know is that he was sufficiently aware to disinvite Reverend Wright from the announcement of his presidential bid back in February of 2007 in Springfield, Illinois. And according to Reverend Wright, he was told by Barack Obama, you know, some of your sermons are a little rough. So the question then becomes, why at one point was he, you know, comfortable with Reverend Wright and the church, and at another moment realizing maybe what Reverend Wright said is a little bit out of control and something that would constitute baggage for someone running for national office?
Here's something that Barack Obama said in a statement. He said, "All of the statements that have been the subject of controversy," he means Reverend Wright's, "are ones that I vehemently condemn. They in no way reflect my attitudes and directly contradict my profound love for this country." Now, another thing this calls up is when his wife, Michelle Obama, talked about pride for the country, you know, and being in a different place with that. Is this fundamentally a conversation about how much it's fair game to critique America if you're African-American and different perceptions people might have along racial lines?
No, you know, this is an interesting argument because it's one that's being advanced, I think, pretty much as an excuse to say, don't pay attention to what Reverend Wright has had to say for Wright. But the fact is that there is something called liberation theology. Some people might refer to it as the social gospel, which speaks to the whole notion of Jesus identifying in Christianity, Jesus identifying with those who were oppressed, those who have had to fight against the system, the powers that be, Moses leading the slaves to freedom. And in that sense, it's always been about inspiration and triumph and identifying as people of God and appealing. And Dr. King did this repeatedly, appeal to whites. If you believe that you're Christians, how can you not view us, your fellow Christians, as your brothers in Christ? That has been liberation theology. Reverend Wright has taken it to another extent when he starts talking about damn America, when he starts suggesting there's a conspiracy to spread AIDS or to kill people. That's what has sparked this controversy, and it's why Barack Obama, a very smart guy, knew right away at the start of his presidential campaign that having Reverend Wright by his side might be a complication. And then, of course, Farai, the whole issue comes in, you know, why was he in this church for so long? And I think the answer is that Barack Obama wanted the association with Reverend Wright early in his career because he wanted to establish himself in the black community and answer questions about who he was, about the fact that his mother was white, that he was Ivy League educated. You know, even that question even dogged him at the start of this campaign. Is he black enough? that kind of thing, I think, was answered for him by saying, hey, I'm a member of the Trinity Church, and Reverend Wright, who, you know, is strongly nationalistic in terms of black identity, is my friend and my mentor. Now that very effort has come back to bite him.
All right. Well, Juan, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Brian.
We were speaking to NPR senior correspondent Juan Williams. He joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. We now continue our conversation about the relationship between Barack Obama and Reverend Jeremiah Wright with Dr. Aubrey Hendricks, a professor at the New York Theological Seminary and the author of The Politics of Jesus, and Ronald Kessler, chief Washington correspondent for Newsmax.com, a former Wall Street Journal reporter, and the author of The Terrorist Watch, Inside the Desperate Race to Stop the Next Attack. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Hendricks, tell us what you know about Reverend Wright.
You know, I first met Reverend Wright at Princeton Theological Seminary. He was an invited lecturer there. And I know him to be a great intellect, an extraordinary servant of his congregation, and, you know, a very pointed social commentator and lover of this country in the tradition of Martin Luther King, in which, you know, we speak the truth to power in order to make this nation fulfill its creed. So I find him to be an extraordinary man, and I'm very, very distressed by the way he's been vilified by so many uninformed commentators.
What exactly is the significance both of this denomination and of his church specifically, the Trinity United Church of Christ?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a predominantly white denomination. It is a real servant force in its community. It has some 60, 70 different ministries, and it's lifted up many, many people. I met one gentleman who had been a drug addict and a convict who told me with tears in his eyes how the church inspired him such that he now owns his own limo business. And so it's an important place, an incubator of thought. There are some radical things that come out of it, but it's in the tradition of the biblical Jeremiads and even in the tradition of Dr. King.
Now, Ron, you have written some articles that really detail very specifically the things that Reverend Jeremiah Wright has said. What struck you the most? What stood out to you the most?
This, you know, hatred of America is pretty shocking, and I just don't see how Barack Obama could attend services there, be his friend, unless he, in fact, shared his views. I don't see how anybody could, you know, choose to go to a church like that unless they liked what they heard, and what he says is that America started the AIDS virus, America hires trains professional killers to kill people, America has oppressed blacks throughout the world, on and on and on and on. It's, of course, disturbing that anybody would want to go to a church like this, and I quote in my Newsmax story Juan Williams, who's gone into this in one of his books called Enough, which addresses this whole black victim or victimology attitude, you know, that, well, of course, there's been racism in society, and you know, Jews have been, 6 million Jews were killed, but that doesn't mean that you go around, you know, assuming that this is a horrible country.
I want to ask you very specifically about one part of your reporting. You did something on Newsmax that appeared on Sunday, March 16th, that said that Obama was in the audience on a July 22nd sermon. And Fox News the next day said, well, you know, we looked into this and it appears that he was in Miami. Have you reconciled what your reporting said versus reports that your reporting did not, you know, was not accurate when it said that Obama was in the church at that time?
I quoted an article by another Newsmax correspondent by the name of Jim Davis, and he has been contacted by Newsmax, and we are going to run a clarification because Davis said that this did happen, but originally he didn't have the date of the service in the story, and the editor said, well, what was the date? He came back with a date, and he says he now says he may have been wrong about the date, but it definitely did happen. And, you know, I think that obviously the larger picture is you simply couldn't belong to this church and not hear these kind of spewing of hate.
So you're acknowledging that one of the details in one of your articles may have been wrong, but you say that the overall point is right.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Please, Obrey, go ahead.
Yeah, I beg to differ. First, you know, there's no spewing of hate. First, as Dr. Martin Luther King said in his Paul's Letter to American Christians sermon, he said, your ultimate allegiance is not to the government. The Christian owes its ultimate allegiance to God. And if any earthly institution conflicts with God's will, it is your Christian duty to take a stand against it. And what we hear from Dr. Wright is a jeremiad, you know, to keep this country from becoming too self-congratulatory and too self-righteous, and in order to keep us from forgetting that we also fall short of the glory of God in the Justice Department. This is no hatred of America, no wanting to destroy America. He's an American. His children are American. His congregation is American. It is an indictment of America that is consistent with the biblical witness. And that's what's so upsetting, is that we have these folks talking so self-righteously against him and against his Christianity without there seeming to have any sense that this is what a Christian, particularly a minister, is called to do, to speak truth to power, to afflict the comfortable and to comfort the afflicted.
I want to move on to some of the other specifics of this conversation. Ron, in your article, you wrote about a Lifetime Achievement Award that the Church's magazine Trumpet gave to Minister Louis Farrakhan. Tell us about that award and its significance.
I think what's especially significant, I mean, besides the fact that Obama didn't leave the church as soon as that happened, which was in December, is that Barack Obama has dissembled about it. When we first broke that story on January 14th, he issued a statement saying that the award was for Farrakhan's work with ex-offenders. That was just false. Both the article in the Church magazine and the presentation never mentioned ex-offenders. It just talked about his lifetime achievement, his wonderful influence on the African-American community. It had quotes heaping praise on him from Reverend Wright himself. So that's a very disturbing aspect of this, that Barack Obama has not been, you know, truthful about what the real issue is here.
Dr. Hendricks, when you look at the big picture here, there is always going to be a huge amount of tension, or I don't want to say always because I'm not God, but there certainly has been historically up until this moment and no doubt further, huge amounts of contention over perception by African Americans of what is out of bounds when you talk about race, government, and responsibility, and by whites. Is this just a question of people listening differently, or is this a question of an absolute where Barack Obama is going to have to draw a line in the sand separating himself from his pastor?
Well, just a couple of things. I want to respond to this Farrakhan thing. You know, Farrakhan was showing appreciation for his efforts to fight racism, and he's said a lot of controversial things, but he has been a consistent speaker against racism. Doesn't mean, though, that Jeremiah Wright supports everything that Farrakhan says or does or believes in. And, by this logic, President Reagan was the foremost supporter of South African apartheid in the Western world. He never, ever repented of that. That's on record. By the logic, though, that Farrakhan must be repudiated and all that, or else you're racist, well, by that logic, it means that anyone who lauds Reagan for his contribution to the conservative agenda must also be a diehard supporter of South African apartheid and all of its institutional white supremacist implications. So, I mean, it's ridiculous for them to try to tar Jeremiah Wright, and particularly Obama, with this kind of brush.
Doctor, let me get Ron in here. Ron, Newsmax, which is your primary outlet at this point, is a conservative publication, and that, of course, there's a role for every ideological publication, and politics is all fought and fraught. Do you believe that you were bringing up these issues in a way that is important for the American people to understand? Was this just a case of gotcha, or is this something that you think all American voters really need to know?
I do, and in fact, you know, my feeling is the opposite situation, where the mainstream media have ignored these stories that we've been doing since early January about the Farrakhan Award, about this Hate America speech, about the fact that this church says on its website, you know, we are unashamedly black, and then defines that. You know, it's such crazy talk. It's hard to remember what it is. I mean, it's just paranoid. And
I'm not ashamed to be black. That's not Why? What's wrong with you?
Well, if a white church said we are unashamedly white, that would be, you know, that would
you
be
don't have to say that because the churches remain white and they continue to support the status quo.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to step in. We're running out of time, but Dr. Hendricks, I have one question for you, and it's very specific, and I want to try to keep the answer narrow.
Okay.
At this point, looking forward, knowing that there are differences between the way many African Americans interpret the meaning, if there is any meaning, to Reverend Jeremiah Wright and to his member of his flock, what Obama should do as a member of the flock and as a very public politician, what is the responsibility of Barack Obama to frame this discussion, and how could he in a way that is respectful of this long-term relationship, but also respectful of the fact that he is a man of all people at this point?
Yeah. Well, I think he really only has to point to his the record of his whole career and the fact that his mother is white. He was raised by white grandparents. And to show, I think that'll put the lie to the specious charges. I don't think he needs to talk a lot about his church. I think he just needs to move forward. And when people, you know, raise the question about whether there's racism, there's no need to dwell on it. There's no victimology, but yes, there is racism, and we see a lot of it expressed in this campaign.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Dr. Obri Hendricks, a professor at the New York Theological Seminary and author of The Politics of Jesus, also with Ronald Kessler, chief Washington correspondent for Newsmax.com and author of The Terrorist Watch, Inside the Desperate Race to Stop the Next Attack. J.P. Morgan buys Bear Stearns for the rock-bottom price of $2 a share, and Chrysler is closing all of its facilities for 2 weeks this summer. Later in the conversation, we'll get some perspective on the auto industry from Jerome Vaughn, news program director for member station WDET in Detroit. But first, we've got Keith Reed. He's a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. He also writes a finance blog for BET called Dollar Out of 15 Cents. Welcome back, Keith.
Hey, Farah.
So this is enormous news. And, you know, it's one of these things where, as someone who is not a part of the financial services industry, you can look at these headlines and say, what does this really mean to me? That's a question I really want to get at. But first of all, explain the mechanics of what exactly happened with Bear Stearns and the company that bought it. What went down?
In a nutshell, what happened was you had a run on the bank, even though Bear Stearns is not actually a bank in the sense that it's not taking deposits and making loans to consumers. What happened was late last week there was some investor worries about the health of Bear Stearns itself. When that happened, you had pretty much a bunch of investors who came back to Bear Stearns and said, "We want our money back now." Margin calls, things of that nature. They all came back and said, "Listen, we need our money back from you now." Well, it's the same thing as if you go to your local branch. If you walked in and said, "I need a grand from your local Bank of America or whatever bank you do business with," you could walk in and get a grand. If 37 or 40 or 50 people walked into that same branch at the same time and said, "I need a grand," they might not be able to just come to the counter and hand out $50,000 all at the same time. So Bear Stearns was put in this position on a massive scale. We're talking billions of dollars worth of margin calls and requests for their money back from investors, all coming within a relatively short period of time. And that put the bank in serious peril, or not the bank, excuse me, they're not a bank, but put Bear Stearns in serious peril of becoming insolvent, and they needed to either be sold at a very, very cheap price, or they needed to file bankruptcy, one or the other.
Now, less than a week ago, their stock was trading near $70 a share. Mm-hmm. To go from 70 to 2 is mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. So that means that mm-hmm. there's a lot of people who have lost a lot of money here. Who are those people, or I assume much of it is institutional investments?
Much of it is institutional, but you have to remember that in today's world, so many things in the financial markets are related. I mean, it is likely that you or I or many people may have lost money indirectly on this deal without even knowing it. I mean, think about the retirement plans that are out there. Think about the 401k plans that people, I mean, you know, many, there may have been Bear Stearns shares in a fund that was held by a mutual fund that is held by your or my retirement plans. So there was an enormous amount of wealth, and it's probably pretty spread out. I mean, obviously, the individual investor is at much less risk unless they're very, very heavily weighted in Bear Stearns shares. But it's possible that investors on an individual level were hurt by this. That many institutions who held a significant amount of Bear Stearns shares were hurt by this.
14,000 Bear Stearns employees. Is there a chance a lot of them will be getting their pink slips?
Yeah, there's a great chance of this. I mean, anytime you have an institution that's as big as Bear Stearns or as any major corporation, when that corporation is acquired, one of the first things you start to see is pink slips. They start to the acquiring company starts to look for efficiencies. They start to look for places where individuals who are doing one job in both companies, you can get rid of one person. So you may have two traders trading the same type of securities. You no longer need those two traders. You may only need one. So I think there's a good chance that you're going to see some job losses across Bear Stearns. And keep in mind that this turmoil is still, there's still fear that this is going to spread to other sectors of the financial services industry.
Okay, so you've got this one big whoosh of money out of the system, people's jobs in jeopardy, fear that it could affect more of the financial services industry. If you're someone who has a job, who is not a major individual investor but does have a retirement plan, what should you be looking for as all of these big stories break out? Is there anything you should do or should you just keep an eye out? How should you approach even learning about these things?
I think you should just keep an eye out. At this stage of the game, there is no reason why I see any individual investor should be running to his broker or going to his or changing a ton of things around in his retirement account. I mean, there is a lot of reason for a lot of cause for worry. There is a lot of reason to be paying attention right now. But this should not shake, I don't think, any individual investor or any individual worker's confidence in the system at this stage of the game. I don't think that we're on the verge of a massive collapse. I do think we're on the precipice of what is probably a more than a mild recession, maybe even a deep one, depending on who you ask. But I don't think that you or I or somebody who's listening today who has a job or who has a 401k should be, you know, pulling money out of the bank or out of their 401k and storing it in their mattress at this point.
All right. Well, Keith, I want to bring in Jerome Vaughn of WDET. Jerome, how you doing?
Very good.
So let's break down things around the auto industry. Last week, Chrysler announced it's going to close all of its plants for 2 weeks in July. Is that unusual? What's behind the move?
Well, it is a bit unusual. Usually, the members of the Big Three will shut down their plants over the summer, sort of in succession to make sure that they've got the tools they need for the new model year. For past few years, GM and Ford have, you know, sent their workers on vacation at roughly the same time. Chrysler is doing it, and everyone, just about everyone, is going to go on vacation at the same time. They say it's to, you know, be efficient. You know, you can turn all the plant lights out at the same time if no one's working there. But industry analysts really see it as a move to really try to cut costs and give the chance a company to retool moving forward.
Have you or your station been able to speak with any employees and find out their perception?
Yeah, I've talked to a few people here and there, and you know, they're you know, for some of them, the biggest concern is that they have to take a vacation at the same time. Some of them, you know, particularly white-collar workers, may have had plans to, you know, take vacations at other times of the year. That's the biggest concern overall. But, you know, some other people are a little worried about what it says altogether about the company. And so there's a little bit of concern there as well.
Keith and Jerome, Keith first, you got a time of high gas prices. You have, for many years now, cars that were built overseas really giving U.S. cars a run for their money. What is going on with the auto industry, Keith, in terms of vulnerability?
It's very vulnerable. I mean, I think, you know, you're starting to see this is evidence of some of the turmoil that you see in the larger economy affecting yet another sector. People, again, there's a credit crunch. People can't borrow as much. Therefore, they're not buying as many big ticket items that they would need to borrow for. There was a story by Joseph Valcourt in the Wall Street Journal last week that talked about auto sales being expected to fall to about 15.5 million vehicles this year. That, she says in her story, was the lowest level in a decade, a million fewer than were sold in 2005. I mean, this is really evidence of just larger turmoil. First, it started in the mortgage market, then went into some of the financial markets. Now it's starting to show its head in other areas, especially on big ticket items.
Jerome, let's take it to another level, which is public transportation. As people feel a pinch in their pocket during this economic downturn, a lot of times you have a lot of growth creation of jobs in the suburbs, and people in the cities like Detroit, have to try to find ways out there. Is Detroit equipped with a system that can get working class people in the city out to the jobs that might be elsewhere?
Plain and simple, the answer is no. Detroit's public transit system has been a work in progress for decades. There have been many efforts to unite the suburban bus system with the city bus system. That really hasn't come to play. And there have been a number of stories over the past few years about someone who lives in the inner city and works out in the suburb may take them 3 or 4 hours on the bus system to get to their job and the same amount of time to get home. So clearly it's not working. And I think that's one of the things that people here are concerned about. I think the other thing is, just to chime on to what Keith said, is, you know, we're talking $4 gallon gasoline. The price of bread is through the roof. And people here in Detroit and elsewhere around the country are worried about that. And so they're not willing to spend as much on a new car because they're worried about just the day-to-day expenses.
Well, Keith and Jerome, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Jerome Vaughn is news program director for member station WDET in Detroit. He spoke with us from its studios. And Keith Reed is an economics reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. He joined us from member station WVXU in Cincinnati, Ohio. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. On our bloggers' roundtable, Detroit's mayor can't seem to shake calls for his resignation. Also, the Supreme Court hears a landmark case aimed at gun control. And should the world's oldest profession become a legal way of doing business? Joining me now to make sense of it all, Ambra Nicole. She blogs at Nicola.com. Also, Eric Brown, blogger for the Detroit News' political and government blog, and Jay Smooth, who video blogs at IllDoctrine.com. Hi, folks.
How are you doing?
Hello.
Hello.
So let's start with a topic dear to your heart, Eric. Your city's mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, the calls for his resignation seem to be getting louder and louder, and they have been getting to the mayor himself. During his State of the City address last week, he went after the city council and the press.
This unethical, illegal, lynch mob mentality has to stop. We've never been in a situation like this before, where you can say anything, do anything, have no facts, no research, no nothing, and you can launch a hate-driven, bigoted assault on a family.
This reminded me a bit of Clarence Thomas's high-tech lynching quote. What does it call up for you, Eric?
Well, for starters, I think that the mayor of Detroit needs to get in front of a mirror and ask himself whether or not he bought this all on himself, which he has. The text messages, which is a minor thing in this whole deal, because the text messages, number one, proved that he lied on the witness stand along with his chief of staff. But for him to get up there and blame the media for saying that they are responsible for going after him with this lynch mob mentality is ridiculous. And anyone that is from Detroit, I mean, I was born and raised in Detroit, I don't live there any longer, should be embarrassed that someone is representing them in this way. He bought this all on himself. Therefore, you pay the price for being a person that is ungodly. And I say that because he constantly wants to say that he is on a mission from God or has been selected by God to become mayor of Detroit. How disingenuous is that?
Ambra, his mother is the head of the Congressional Black Caucus. I'm talking about Congresswoman Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick. It's got to be an awkward position. But, you know, Kwame Kilpatrick is part of a political dynasty. And do you think that that plays at all into how he views his role in government?
Absolutely. I think that originally I think there was intent to sort of set him up to be, you know, the great black hope in a lot of respects in politics, you know, that he could go pretty far into Congress and even potentially into the presidency. But I have to agree, you know, I think that with a, you know, previous person that just commented that I think
Eric.
That yes, thank you, Eric. I just have an issue with, I mean, as far as him telling everyone else that they can do and whatever they want to do, I think he thinks that he can do whatever he wants to do because he has been the golden child in so many respects. But I mean, I have to say, I think that the writing's on the wall on this one.
Now, Jay, there have been calls for his impeachment, for his resignation. We've talked about this on the show before, and there's, you know, there's a question of whether or not African-American voters are willing to step up and really push for the removal of a black elected official, or if that is too painful. Do you think that the electorate will end up backing away from some of the support that's existed so far?
I would think at some point there has to be a backing away. I mean, I think it's only natural, given the long history of persecution of African-American leaders in this country, the people's first instinct is to give them the benefit of the doubt and back them up. But I think the longer that this goes on and you see the tremendous sense of entitlement that he has and the hubris that he has about seeming to think he can get away with anything, as you saw even in his text messages where he says, "I'm the mayor, LOL," as if he's untouchable. I think eventually they have to see that. I mean, we see the story of this woman, Tamara Green, who may or may not have been at this party in the mayor's mansion and later was killed. And I think, you know, beyond how that fits into this soap opera, the real tragedy of that is it's one of so many murders that have happened in Detroit, and there's so much crime and poverty and serious issues that they're facing. And the longer that Kwame Kilpatrick stays in office, the longer he perpetuates this soap opera and takes resources and attention away from all the serious issues Detroit is facing. So I think after a while, the public has to get tired of that and get ready for things to change.
Eric, give us a little bit more detail on how the Tamara Green investigation is playing out. This was a murder case involving a woman who, according to some reports, may have performed as an exotic dancer at the mayor's mansion. There's obviously a lot of he said, she said, they said in this, but what are people drawing from the published news reports on this?
Okay, what people are drawing from is the fact that the rumor never died. This is an event that took place, you know, years ago, and here we are in 2008 still talking about it. And there's a reason why the rumor even existed to begin with. Some rumors just die slowly, some die fast. This has been an ongoing issue, and the rumor has become so much more believable based on the fact that here you have a guy that is the mayor of the city, and to piggyback just a little bit, even in 2005, he was only elected with 117,000 votes in a city of, 900,000 people. So there is a sense that a lot of people have already checked out on him. So, and to get back to Tamara Green, is the fact that why is it that the rumor never died? Well, when you get on the stand and you tell a lie, the sense of the people is, what else is it that you may have lied about? And when you have someone has come forward to say that I saw a police report of Tamara Green turning into the police saying that I was beat up by the mayor's wife, that further validates the rumor to become more believable.
Well, we're going to leave that alone for now. It is playing out in the news media, but there is a lot of speculation. I want to say that. But I want to move on to something that is, well, people call it the world's oldest profession. We're talking about prostitution. Of course, the New York governor, Eliot Spitzer, a former New York governor, resigned after being completely swamped with allegations that he'd spent $80,000 on prostitutes. Kristen was the name for the high-end prostitute he allegedly slept with. Her legal name is Ashley Alexandra Dupre, and you can go on to MySpace and listen to her music. So, all that aside, Ambra, let me start with you. I want to ask you about different options around prostitution. One is to keep it illegal, but in the U.S., prostitution is effectively legal in certain cases in two states, Nevada, Rhode Island. In Rhode Island, you can pay for sex if it takes place indoors. Don't ask me why. And in parts of Nevada, brothels are allowed by law. So, what about the other 48 states? Do you think people should reconsider, given how much prostitution there is in the U.S., do you think that states should reconsider or municipalities should reconsider whether or not it should be legalized or decriminalized?
Absolutely not. I don't think that the prevalence of anything in our society is licensed to legalize it. I think that there are aspects of prostitution that are harmful to society, harmful to the individuals, and I don't necessarily think that legalizing it is going to help anything.
Now, Jay, in the Netherlands, prostitution is considered a legal profession, just like being a teacher or a police officer. They have the right to unionize, run ads for their services, collect government benefits, and they have to get an extensive amount of medical testing. Are there some goals, like health goals around the spreading of AIDS and STDs, that might be in conflict with some of the other goals, like let's not have prostitution at all? And how do we as citizens and the government make decisions about which goals are foremost?
I mean, I think it's a complicated question, and I see disagreement even among feminist and women's groups on the best way to handle it. But I think the reality for most people in the sex industry is a lot less glamorous than people who are working for the Emperor's Club. And I mean, it's an industry that's very exploitative for the women who wind up as sex workers. And I think whatever laws we have in place should be set up to protect those women from exploitation rather than persecuting and shaming them. And I think maybe decriminalizing, if not straight up legalizing, would go a long way towards making sure those women are protected.
Eric, before he was deposed, Spitzer worked on legislation around trafficking, around taking girls and women and bringing them into the U.S. for prostitution. Arguably, legalizing prostitution would also undermine trafficking. Do you buy that argument?
Well, to a sense, but that was Spitzer's major problem. You are policing something that you, in turn, get caught up in. And I think if you're going to legalize it, one of the things that's very important to do is find a way whereas both the John and the prostitute are prosecuted equally. And I think that's one of the major issues a lot of feminist groups have is the fact that you prosecute the women vigorously and the Johns get, you know, these misdemeanors. And that's not fair if you're going to have a situation where, okay, it's illegal, so why is it that the men are not being prosecuted as much as the women?
All right. If you're just tuning in, here's a quick rundown of who's on the line for our bloggers roundtable. This is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. You were just hearing from Eric Brown, blogger for the Detroit News' political and government blog. We've also got Ambra Nicole, who blogs at Nicola.com, and Jay Smooth, who video blogs at IllDoctrine.com. I want to move us on to another controversial topic. This is going to hit the U.S. Supreme Court tomorrow. District of Columbia v. Heller revolves around an individual's right to keep a licensed handgun in his or her own home. The Second Amendment case is complicated because it involves Washington, D.C., which is not a state. D.C. has some of the strictest handgun laws on the books, and some observers are concerned that if this case overturns D.C.'s handgun prohibitions, it could mean serious problems with gun violence on the city streets. So, Jay, let me ask you about this case. In terms of the rise and fall of gun violence on the streets, what happens if the court effectively says D.C. citizens should be licensed to keep handguns at home for self-defense? Does that change the game, make the city more dangerous?
I mean, not living in D.C., it's hard for me to say definitively, but I think I'm always ambivalent about this because I think we need as many controls as we can to limit the use of guns, but I feel like America just has such a deep-seated cultural connection to guns and violence that if people really want guns, they're always going to find a way to have them. And you know, I would be hesitant to tamper too much with the Constitution in order to try to stop something that just runs deeper than that. So, I think we should do whatever we can within the law to make sure that there are limits and things are being handed out properly. But I don't know. It's hard for me to say. It's a tough question.
Now, what do you think, Eric? Do you think that the link between gun control and gun violence is clear and strong? It's been debated a million times.
Well, growing up in Detroit, where at one time we were known as the, you know, murder capital of the world, it's a very difficult issue because, you know, look at Dick Heller. He has a gun every single day when he goes to work, and he has to leave that gun somewhere on his way home. And it's also about the matter of being able to protect your family. D.C. is also a high-crime area, and it's sort of like a contradiction to not allow someone that works every day with a gun to not let him take it home. So gun controls are what they are, but just like Jay said, people find a way to get guns, so some laws that are on the book kind of don't make sense to begin with.
Amber, how do you fall on this? I mean, there's so many different facets of it. There's what is legal. There's what is possible. That is, you know, people are able to take assault weapons across state and county lines, even when they're not legal. If you're involved in gang violence or you want to purchase an illegal weapon, many times you're able to get it. And there's what's moral. How do you, again, since we're talking in this broad level about making decisions as citizens that affect other people, how do you make a decision about how you fall on this?
I mean, I think at the end of the day, the one thing America refuses to do on this issue is to really look at human nature and the people who are behind the guns. And I think that, you know, regardless of if we take them off the streets or whatever the case may be, people will find a way to exhibit violence towards one another. It does scare me a bit to not have any guns at all. I mean, to be moving towards a society where, you know, average citizen can't carry a handgun, especially looking at the economy and some of the things that are to come. It's interesting to see, you know, I think that weapons might be of a lot more of importance in the future than they are even now. So
it's a like that saying, an armed society is a polite society. You believe that?
I think I do to some degree. I think I don't think we're dealing with the root issues. I think there's a lot. I think gang violence stems much deeper than having whether or not they have guns. I think it has a lot to do with lack of fathers. I mean, so many different things. So in any case, I just don't think that this is the big issue.
Eric and Jay, do you think that the issue of guns really is much more a fundamental issue about how we operate morally within this society and that the gun issue is just secondary or tertiary? Eric first.
It's secondary because there are, it's secondary. Matter of fact, maybe even tertiary because look at so many other issues, drugs and, you know, just like Amber said, the lack of fathers in the household. So there are more other issues more prevalent than just having a gun because, again, I just go back to the fact that if you want to get a gun, there's a way to get them. So,
Jay, what about you? How important is it for you to focus on issues like gun control versus other issues that are affecting urban communities?
Oh, well, I think the key issue with gun control, as was said by both of the other panelists, is, gun control is basically putting a Band-Aid on a problem that should have been healed much earlier in the story. I mean, there's so much economic hardship and lack of economic educational opportunities and lack of other things for people to get involved in that leads up to the point where someone is getting involved in gun violence. And I think we need to work on all those cultural, socio-political issues to actually cure the disease instead of continuing to put a Band-Aid on it with gun control, although gun control is a necessary measure, perhaps, to add on to that.
Correct.
And do you think that the cities need to work together, Eric, to do a better job of coming up with policies that deal with gun violence? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of commonalities. Just briefly.
Okay, you say, well, they do, but when you have areas of the country and pockets of the country where they have all these militias, how much continuity will there really be?
All right. On that note, we're going to have to wrap it up. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking with Amber Nicole. She blogs at Nicola.com and joined me from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Jay Smooth, who video blogs at IllDoctrine.com. He was at our NPR studios in New York. And Eric Brown, blogger for the Detroit News' political and government blog.